From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is fascinated by Hollywood, by acting. And while the glitz and glamour is no doubt captivating, we are hardly unaware that it is not life without challenges. Stories of drug abuse, highly publicized burnouts, and death seem to fill the news. James Franco has an inside view, a multi-talented man who knows a thing or two about acting. In his new book, he takes a hard look behind the mask at the true meaning of being an actor. This hour on Point, James Franco and his debut novel, Actors Anonymous. You can join us on air or online. What are your questions for James Franco on writing, on what goes on behind the mask? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me now from WNYC in New York City is James Franco, actor, Academy Award nominee, director, producer, musician, teacher, and now novelist. The new book is Actors Anonymous, and you can read an excerpt at our website and also a trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. James Franco, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much.
So start us off here and tell us a little bit about the structure of the novel and the story.
So the structure of the novel is, I think, kind of unusual. There are several aspects that take it out of the realm of what maybe is expected of a novel. From the title, you can gather that it's kind of framed as a recovery book, you know, Actors Anonymous, sort of like Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, whatever. And that was a structure that came to me maybe halfway through putting it together with my editor, Ed Park. And I guess what I found is in these books, especially the granddaddy of them all, of recovery books, Alcoholics Anonymous, there are two basic sections. There's the section that outlines a program of recovery and how to walk through what are now known as the 12 steps. And then there are these sections that are just stories. And I guess along the way, I thought it would – I was writing these stories for my MFA programs at, you know, Columbia and these programs in New York. And I had – a collection of stories that went together thematically, but they all dealt with different characters. And so I guess along the way I thought, well, if I frame them as sort of like these testimonies about people, you know, getting through something or going over something or telling these stories in order for other people to relate to them, like the stories in the recovery books do, that they would function as short stories normally do, but they would have this added emphasis of really trying to like reach out and say, hey, look at my story. I understand something about, I guess in this case, acting or Hollywood or trying to, you know, make something of my life or whatever it may be. And it would have this kind of extra little emphasis of like, trying to reach out and grab the reader. So
let me play a little from the book trailer. This is for James Franco's novel, Actors Anonymous. And it features Franco and a cast of actors reading from the early part of this novel.
I'm Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando, and Jimmy Stewart, and Belmondo, and Steve McQueen.
I'm Nicolas Cage and Robert Pattinson, James Dean and Rock Hudson.
I am Norma Shearer and Lillian Gish.
I'm Garbo.
I'm like a sophisticated prop.
I'll give you all the feeling you want.
And accents you want.
All the hairstyles and wardrobe changes you want. I'll say whatever you put in front of me.
But do not expect me to take pride in the work.
I used to care about how I looked. Now I don't care as much. Maybe it's because I'm so handsome.
James Franco, that makes being an actor sound pretty depressing. Is it the case that acting is sometimes an effort devoid of pride?
Okay, well, I feel like there are several things going on in that section, or at least what I'm attempting is I'm talking about some specific things about acting, although I would argue, you know, maybe everyone just sees through it. I would argue that all of those things are coming from a persona. I wouldn't say that those are, you know, bald statements coming directly from my heart. I would say that those are, you know, coming from this persona that is present throughout the book. But that being said, they are statements about acting. They are kind of creating an atmosphere. And then what it's also trying to do is, while getting at some specific things about the acting life or what it feels like to be a professional actor, it's also trying to use those specific things to talk about more universal things. So meaning it, what the book tries to do is turn acting into a, I guess you could say, metaphor or a lens through which to look at life. And so that when I say acting in the book, it can actually be applied, it be transposed with the word just living or being human and going through life. And in that, in the sense that, you know, I know some people will roll their eyes or it'll sound pretentious or just silly, but in the sense that I think every day we put on a mini performance. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, reality TV works. And in what I mean is, each day we choose our wardrobe, we put on specific clothes, and those are clothes that are not other clothes. You know, we have a wide range of things that we could wear. And then, like characters in movies, sometimes things are imposed on us. So maybe our character can't buy Gucci suits to wear every day, but there are plenty of characters in movies that can't, that don't wear Gucci suits. So certain things are imposed on you, and then you go and you have an occupation, and you're, you know, there are expectations of how you behave in that occupation. You can either choose to go along with them or go against them. And in that sense, each day is a mini performance. And so so when I say talk about acting in the book, or the characters talk about acting, I think it applies to everyone, or it can.
So how do you look at your own life then, James Franco, through the lens of your life as an actor?
I mean, I guess in that way, when I was writing this book, I also understood that my life is, you know, fairly unusual, because I have a public persona that is partially generated by things that I do, and it's partially generated by what people write about me, by how people perceive me in the movies that I do or the different projects that I do. All of these things come together and create this public image of me that I feel is both me and isn't me. So I guess when I go through my day, there are parts of my day that are, I guess, the private me, and there are parts that, you know, are seen and by a wider audience. And what I've come to understand is that I can't really control how people see me or want to see me or what boxes they want to put me in or if they want to engage with what I'm doing or just write me off. I mean, those are things that I really have no control over. I don't have control over the results. What I have control over is what I, you know, focus on and how hard I work at it. So I guess you could say that my performance in life is one where I've worked it out so that I get to, you know, work on all the things that I that I believe in and love. I have a very good life. So I'm very happy with my performance.
Well, we're talking this hour with actor, director, and now novelist James Franco. To add to his talents, James Franco also has a band. So we'll go out on this break with Love in the Old Days by James Franco's band with Tim O'Keefe, Daddy. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point. You know these aren't the games I like to
play. When I met you, you were my mother. Late father, and I thought life was unfolding as it should. We painted pictures, and we were the picture of my parents as they fell in love. Old movies of Brando and Tennessee Williams should have warned me about love, but I was blind, blind when I was with you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with A-lister James Franco this hour about life in Hollywood and his debut novel, Actors Anonymous. I want to play a clip here, James. This is a scene from the 2001 biopic about the life of James Dean. And Dean, played by you, approaches James Whitman, played by David Parker, about attending his acting school. Dean began attending Whitmore's acting workshops in 1949 while attending college at UCLA.
Are you any good?
Well, I did a couple plays in high school, and people said I was pretty good, but I don't want to be just good. I want to be great.
Get any money?
No. Sure don't.
Great ones never do.
James Franco, are the stakes a little higher when you're portraying the life of a person that existed in recent history?
You're talking about James Dean?
Yeah.
That recent? Oh, it was like, yeah, he died over 50 years ago, but mm-hmm. I guess that's
still
recent.
Well, that's recent to some of us.
Okay. Well, yeah, in the case of James Dean after James Dean, I eventually played Allen Ginsberg. There is a lot of pressure because there is a lot of love for those artists, and they're also personalities that are recognizable. And so when you play those parts, there's the expectation and pressure to not only capture the inner life and tell the story on screen, you have to catch the physicality of those characters and the way that they speak and move exactly. But you have to do it in a way that feels natural, you know, and so it can't just be a Saturday Night Live sketch of those characters. That you have to have all the details, the surface details, and somehow create the inner life, the soul of those people, so that it doesn't feel like you're putting something on. It feels like it's the actual person. Mm. So there is a lot of pressure.
By any account, you are a tremendously accomplished, multi-talented person. Acting, teaching, directing, editing, photography, producing. You're an artist. You're a musician. And all the characters in this book have, I guess, really interesting reasons for acting. I wondered if you'd tell us how you got your start as an actor.
Sure. Let's see. I mean, all the things that you just named, I think all come from a similar place, and my interests in all of those things started around the same time when I was in high school. I think from a very young age I was interested in literature and film, and I remember reading, you know, the Oz books, the L. Frank Baum Oz books when I was young, the Tolkien books, some of Steinbeck's books, like The Red Pony and stuff, at a very young age. And then that developed into, like, my love of Faulkner that started, you know, when I was 16. And that's around when I started acting. I loved movies, but I was, I think, shy. And the reason I was shy is that I feared embarrassment. And I guess I thought that embarrassment on stage, because that's all that was offered, you know, when I was in high school. There was nobody was really making films or videos when I was in high school. Embarrassment on stage felt like it would be the worst kind of most public embarrassment ever. And so it kept me from really trying it in a full-hearted way until I was about 17. And I had a girlfriend who was in the acting department at school, and there's this guy in her class who wrote a one-act play, and of all the people, asked my girlfriend to be in it with him, and it was a romantic play, and I think they even kissed in it, and it just drove me crazy. And I think at the time I thought I was being driven crazy because here was a guy kissing my girlfriend on stage. But in hindsight, I think it was actually that here was this guy who was acting, doing everything that I wanted to do, and writing, and putting him and directing his own thing. It was like everything that I wanted to do, and doing it with my girlfriend. And so that was probably the actual motor behind my jealousy. And so my revenge was, I mean, I begged her not to do it, and she rightfully did it anyways. And so my revenge was to show her by joining the acting class and doing it myself. And I was, after joining the acting class, I was cast as a lead in the last two plays of my senior year. I played Wojciech in the George Buchner play, and I played Prince Mishkin in my teacher's adaptation of Dostoevsky's The Idiot.
That's a great story. That's a great story. So we have a question here from our Facebook page. Garrett, with this new novel in mind, wants to know, what are your writing habits and who are your literary influences? And is being famous a hard layer to shake off when trying to be taken seriously as a writer?
Those are all good questions. My writing habits are, I think, like a lot of my other creative habits. There are times and circumstances that are more conducive to writing than others. For a long time, I thought that writing and, in high school, that's also when I started, you know, art and painting and everything. I thought, oh, I need full concentration and I shouldn't listen to music and no distractions or whatever. Now I find that I love listening to music when I write, and it actually enables me to write anywhere because the music, if I just put on some headphones, it can isolate me from whatever's going on around me. So that enables me to write in a car. I can write, you know, in a cafe. I can write on set or whatever. So that's kind of the way I do it. I mean, in my life doesn't really enable me. Like, if I only could write, like, in my office or something, I probably wouldn't get half of my work done. So I need to be able to write in a lot of different places because of my the way my life is scheduled. And I usually like to write. I don't usually write late at night. I used to, but I don't usually write late at night because I find that because I do so much, I do get tired. So I need to schedule my activities so that the activities that aren't going to put me to sleep, like reading or writing, I don't do late at night. I like watch movies late at night because I can stay up better. So I usually write in the morning if I can, or, you know, maybe in the afternoon.
And who are your literary influences?
I have a lot. I mean, I have a bachelor's degree in English literature, and I have gone to many, many graduate writing programs, and I now am getting a PhD in English literature. So I've found a lot of writers along the way that I love, like too many writers. And that's one of the reasons you know, I direct a lot of movies and I usually do adaptations. And one of the reasons I think I just keep piling them on is because I feel like there are so many stories that I want to tell on screen. So I just, I feel like I need to just race through them. But, so I'll just name some influences that were very helpful when writing this book. Dennis Johnson is just an all-time favorite, and his book, Jesus' Son, is one of the Bibles of MFA writing programs, or at least the ones I went to. It's a collection of interconnected short stories that follows a character. I know I'm not supposed to swear on air, so his name is blank blank head. Blank 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 head. And that's a great book. And just the way, just his the way he makes the prose so subjective. It's the character is a drug addict, and the prose takes on aspects of his drug-induced mind space very, very well. And it's elevated into, you know, art because of how he uses that intoxicated state. And then also I'll just name a few others. David Shields' book, Reality Hunger, was very, very helpful. And the way that he brings in, is a huge advocate of bringing in nonfiction into novels and what we expect of novels, and kind of subverting that by different methods of appropriation and the use of nonfiction and collage. And then he actually introduced me to a writer named he was a teacher of mine, and he introduced me to a writer named David Markson, whose novel called This Is Not a Novel really helped with certain sections in this book, especially sections like the one that you just aired, where it's a grouping of statements about acting or living or life, just one after another. And so it's not what you expect of a kind of fluid narrative. It's more blocky, but those disparate segments sort of add up to something by their groupings.
Let me get a call in here. Jane is on the line from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Jane. Welcome to On Point with James Franco.
Hi.
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 I had a question. I just came back from New York and saw As I Lay Dying. I had a question about why you chose to use the split screen as you did in the movie.
Sure. So I obviously have a lot of things going on at one time, and they're kind of different projects put out by different entities. So my book is put out by Amazon, and then I have this movie that's put out by Millennium Films. So I guess they didn't really work in conjunction. So everything kind of, a lot of things came out this one weekend. And one of the other things is this movie, As I Lay Dying, an adaptation of Faulkner's great, great novel. And so the question is, why did I use split screen in the film? And if you know the book, it's structured in such a way that each chapter is told from the first person perspective of a different character. Each chapter, but they're all telling or adding pieces to the same story. Basically, how their mother died, and they took her body to town to be buried, and all the trials that they have along the way, and so I knew when I chose that book to adapt that it wouldn't be enough just to get the story. That if I wanted to be loyal to the book, that I would also have to capture the style and the structure in some way. And so I wanted that multiple perspective feeling that you get from, you know, the different chapters being told by different people. But I felt like if I told it exactly like the book, you know, one section is this character, one section is this character, one section is this character, one section is this character. It would feel a little clunky. It would feel choppy. And so we came across this idea of possibly using split screen so that you'd have this feeling of multiple people looking at a single scene. And then so you'll get two different shots of the same scene happening at the same time. Or in other parts of the film, you'll get different scenes from in different locations being played at the same time. So the character Dewey Dell, the daughter, is at a pharmacy trying to get an abortion, and then the family is in the cemetery burying the mother. And
you know what, James? I actually have a clip from As I Lay Dying, which you actually directed and also starred in. The film is taken from William Faulkner's 1930 novel. Here it is.
The dark current runs. Fading swirls move along the surface for an instant. Silent and permanent. Profoundly significant. As though something just beneath the surface has waked for a moment.
James Franco, you seem to have a special place in your heart for Faulkner. I think this is the first of two projects adapted from his work, no?
Exactly. Yeah. I directed this last summer, and it just came out this weekend in New York, and hopefully we'll go wider this next weekend. And then I just finished shooting an adaptation of Sound and the Fury, believe it or not, in Mississippi a week ago. And I've just loved Faulkner since, like I said, since I was a teenager. There was a period in high school where I was getting in a lot of trouble, and then to remedy that, I stopped kind of going out and, you know, doing what I had been doing, and I had to fill that time with other things. And one of those things was literature. And my dad, I remember very clearly him giving me As I Lay Dying, and then recommending Sound and the Fury. And I remember just reading those, like, on, you know, a Friday and Saturday night when normally I would have just been out, you know, causing trouble. I was at home reading Faulkner, and I've just loved him ever since.
Well, we're talking to James Franco this hour about a life in the spotlight and his rise in Hollywood. He's got a new novel out. It's called Actors Anonymous. Behind me, more music from Franco's band Daddy. This is Crime, featuring the great Smokey Robinson. More with James Franco after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You were a crime I had to commit. You were a crime. You were a crime I had to commit. When I think of what I've become,
what I've become,
I know that I could have had something more.
Something more.
I could have had love with so many.
Well, well.
I could have had love with just about any.
But you were a crime.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with James Franco this hour. He's out with a debut novel, Actors Anonymous. Here's a clip from a 2010 film, Howl, which explores the life of American poet Allen Ginsberg. In this scene, Ginsberg, played by James Franco, reads from his most famous poem, Howl.
Breakthroughs, over the river, flips and crucifixions, gone down the flood, highs, epiphanies, despairs, 10 years, animal screams and suicides, minds, new loves, mad generation, down the rocks of time, real holy laughter in the river. They saw it all.
James Franco from the movie Howl. A lot of listeners with questions for you, James. Try to get as many as we can in here. Let's go to Boston first. Luke is on the line. Hi, Luke. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Hi, James.
Hi.
Hey.
I had a question about when you played Aaron Ralston in 127 Hours. And I read the book. I loved it. And there's a scene where you as Aaron is actually cutting through the bone and the sinew and the nerve of your arm as he's trying to extract himself from the canyon.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the process was, the direction, et cetera, but the way it's recreated tries to stimulate that sensation of cutting the nerve. And yeah. it was so powerful, I almost blacked out in the movie theater. I had to get up and walk out.
Yeah. I think a lot of people did, or some of them were carried out because they passed out.
I almost did. I was this close to passing out. What was that like?
Well, I actually am very queasy around blood, especially for some reason, blood on my arms. I have big veins for whatever reason. People tell me if I had ever, you know, started shooting up that it would be very easy for me, to do that. I never have, but I hate having my blood drawn at checkups and stuff like that. And so I thought that scene was going to be very difficult for me to get through. Obviously, I didn't cut off my own arm, but they made these very anatomically accurate fake arms that had fake skin on the surface and then muscles and veins and nerves underneath. So I could actually cut through them, and we could do, you know, they had cameras that could do very long takes. So we're talking like 20 minute, maybe even 30 minute takes. And so we had, I think we did it with maybe 2.5 arms, and I just did it the whole way through, and they just filmed the whole process. And I surprisingly was not, my friend and cinematographer, Christina Voros, she's my cinematographer on my films. She was actually on 127 Hours shooting behind the scenes. And in her documentary, there's a little clip of me saying, "Hey, Danny, I think Danny Boyle," I was talking to Danny Boyle, and I think I say, like, I was actually getting a little queasy looking at that. So I guess it did make me queasy, but not to the point where I passed out, because I have, at one time in high school, I did try to give blood and actually passed out at the blood drive. So that didn't happen, but I was getting queasy. And
you know, that was an interesting movie, James, because you weren't working with any other actors. You were stuck in one spot. This is a film about a story, a hiker who was pinned by a boulder who, as you discussed here, ultimately amputates his arm to survive. But it's not like, you know, Castaway, where Tom Hanks is alone, but he's got a whole island to walk around, and you're in one spot the whole time. But the movie had pace and energy. And how did you make a static situation so dynamic?
Well, I think there were several things that were helping. I mean, first of all, you have Danny Boyle, who is a master storyteller on film, and so he did a lot of the, you know, figuring out how to make it work. And one of the things that he decided was that, if you know the book, there's all this backstory leading up to the, you know, entrapment in the canyon, and then there's this whole kind of parallel story of the rescue mission and how the family figured out he was missing and, you know, trying to find him, all that. Well, Danny said, we're going to cut all that out, and we're just going to stay in the canyon. And that will create a kind of pressure cooker situation where the audience going into this film will know the story. Everyone's going to know that he cuts his arm off. It's going to be the movie where the guy cuts his arm off. So when the audience goes in, as soon as the character, I mean, even before the character's trapped, you know, there's a little section where he's walking with these female hikers and he's joking around. It's like even the jokes have this ominous feeling. You know, it's a very light scene, and they like jump into this hot springs together and stuff. all, even that is filled with this kind of foreboding because everyone knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
as soon as the character's trapped, it's as if the audience is trapped there with him. Mm. And we're all just waiting for the scene where he cuts his arm off. And so it creates this incredible tension. And I remember when that movie came out, people were saying it was like, it felt like one of the most action-filled movies ever. And I think a lot of it was just because of that anticipation. And now, a lot of it also is just the way Danny cut, you know, it's the subtle art of cutting around and making a character in a single location feel dynamic by the way it's shot and edited together and stuff like that. Yeah, all of that was contributing.
Luke, thanks for the call and the initial question. Here's Jared in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Jared. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. James, I have a very general question for you. How do you estimate the value?
You have a great voice. Awesome voice.
Oh, thanks. How do you estimate the value of another human being?
Estimate the value of another.
In what sense, Jared? What do you mean?
Well, I only hypothesize that in understanding the value of a person you interpret or portray, you would be better able to bring that said person to life.
I see what you're saying. So as an actor, like when I'm taking on a role, like how do I value a character that I'm going to play? Or at
how
least
see the value in them, yes.
Yes. There's a lot, so it's a very good question. And when going into a movie as an actor and getting ready to play a character, there's a lot that is weighed and considered. So you first have to consider what the movie is that you're doing. What is the context that this character is going to be put in? So, for example, if I'm playing James Dean, there is the James Dean, and first you have to say, okay, well, what is the movie's take on James Dean? Are we doing a loyal kind of study of James Dean that's based on what maybe we know about his psychology and what he went through in his life? Okay, yes. The one that I did, we could say yes. But then you look at, well, what are the scenes that are being portrayed? What are they adding up to? What story about James Dean are we trying to tell? Because obviously we can't fit every scene of his life into the movie. So what are the scenes that are being chosen and to what purpose? And I think in the film that we did, it was like, well, they're using the fact that his mother died when he was 8 and his dad, when that happened, his dad sent him away to live with his aunt and uncle in, Indiana. And so he felt rejected at a very young age, and you could read his three film roles, East of Eden, Rebel Without a Cause, and Giant as, expressions of this rejection and a simultaneous need for the love he maybe didn't get from his father, and at the same time rebellion against the same kind of authority figures. And so you look at that and you say, all right, that's what I'm trying to help tell. That's the story I'm trying to help tell as an actor. And then I always, no matter what movie I'm in, whether I'm playing a villain or a hero, I look for ways to give a little variety to the performance. Now, I know sometimes in a supporting role that I only need to be a one-note character. Forrester talks about this in his book, Aspects of a Novel. Sometimes you have a main character and you want that character to have multiple aspects. And then sometimes you have a supporting character, and to make that character too complex would muddy the waters, would take focus away from where you need it. So sometimes I just accept, like, okay, I'm the supporting character. So just do that, support. So in something like Milk, where I played Scott Smith, I say, all right, there's this guy, Scott Smith. He was a real person. He had a whole life, just like Harvey Milk, many aspects to his life. But this movie is called Milk. It's not called Smith. So I don't want to go in there and try and, you know, show all the aspects of Scott Smith. What is my function in this movie? It's to play the loyal boyfriend who then can't hang in there with Harvey Milk because he keeps doing these political campaigns and he's just too busy. And so I just need to play that. And if I just do that, it will be enough. And it was. You know, I got some awards for that, whatever.
Here's another call from Roy in Houghton, Michigan. Roy, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Mr. Franco. I have a three-part question for you, but I'm going to make it really quick. So my favorite character that you played was in Pineapple Express. I know that you've played many other characters that are much more poetically deep and, you know, philosophically, you know.
Saul's got his place.
But the lovable, compassionate drug dealer in Pineapple Express actually really reached to me because I think we've all kind of met that person or hung out with that person in our lives. And so my questions for you are, what role did you play in basically shaping that character? And what value do you put on the ego? And how do you use, like, the ego when you're kind of getting into character? And also, when you were in high school, what would your favorite character that you played would be, do you think?
Roy, thank you. James, we're running out of time, so if you could
okay.
quickly
Sorry, I'll
get
try to
this.
Give a quick answer about Saul. I actually think Saul is a very important character, and he's an important character in my career. It was, you know, Pineapple Express was a movie that I did around the same time that I went back to school. And it was a period in my life when I was restructuring things because things weren't working well the way I'd been doing them. I took myself as a young actor, I took myself too seriously. Some people might say I still take myself too seriously or whatever, but I actually don't. And one of the things that Pineapple Express taught me is that I can make movies with my friends. I can have fun doing it. I don't need to torture myself or people around me in order to make something good and that touches people. And those were very, very important lessons to me, for me. And with Saul, I even wrote a poem about it. It's coming out in another book. I won't promote it right now, but it's a book of poetry called Directing Herbert White that's coming out next year. And basically what I talk about in that poem regarding Saul is that, yes, it's a stoner comedy, you know, but it works where you could say a lot of other movies in that genre don't go or don't – I wouldn't say they don't work, but they don't go as deep because underneath everything it might sound like a very simple thing, but is the bromance. And the reason that the bromance in, you know, Apatow films and Seth Rogen films was – so popular is because it wasn't just it allowed deeper emotions to come into these comedies. It allowed something more to happen, that underneath these were relationship movies. And so it took it from a movie that would be just a bunch of sketches or a bunch of jokes and put emotion underneath. And so Saul is somebody that actually wants to connect to another human being. He's a really lonely guy. And so Dale, Seth's character, is the one person that kind of comes into his world that he wants to connect to. And so the movie is sort of a love story. It's a bromance. And that's, I think, why it works in the way that it does and why people respond to it so much. Mm.
Only got about a minute left, James Franco, but a question here from our Facebook listener, from Melissa, who asks, is there any form of art you haven't experimented with that's on your list of things to do?
I guess two things that I've flirted with are but I haven't done as much as these other things are. I'd love to. I love plays. I love theater. I wrote plays when I was younger, so I'd love to do that. But the other thing is interviewing. You know, I love doing what you do. I love learning about people, and interviewing is one of the absolute best ways to do it. So. I've done it some in the past, and I hope to do a bit more in the future.
Well, we've enjoyed learning a little bit about you today, a little bit more about you, James Franco. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun.
James Franco, Academy Award nominated actor, director, screenwriter, producer, teacher, artist, and author of a new novel, Actors Anonymous. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.